Today's message is the first in a new series of sermons following the theme of dancing with the scars. How dare you, Pastor, use the word dancing in a Baptist church, but that's what we're going to talk about. As you know, ABC Network has one of the most popular television programs that's been going on since 2005, I believe it is, and it's called Dancing with the Stars. And that's, of course, a program about dancing where you take a professional dancer, match them up with a celebrity, and put them through some very grueling exercises of practicing and rehearsing and then performing and being judged and hopefully to be a winner. Well, we're taking this theme, Dancing with the Stars, but using the idea of scars rather than stars, because there are scars in life that we must deal with and, if you please, dance with and hopefully be rewarded victoriously when we deal with them in a proper way. And so over the next several weeks, the Lord willing, we're going to be looking at some difficulties, problems, scars, trials, triumphs, and so forth in our lives that through the power and grace of Almighty God, we are able to overcome them. And today we're going to be looking at the idea of breaking the cycle of a dysfunctional family. Breaking the cycle of a dysfunctioning family. Let's look at the book of Genesis, chapter 50. I'm going to begin reading with verse 14. After Joseph had buried his father, he returned to Egypt, he and his brothers, and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong which we did to him?" So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father charged before he died, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' But Joseph said to them, 'Do not be afraid, for I am in God's place. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones.' So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them." So just leave your place there. We're coming back to it, but take your Bibles and go back to the 12th chapter of Genesis. I want to walk you through the life of one of the most dysfunctional families that the world has ever heard about, especially in the book of Genesis. Let me begin by saying, giving you a definition of dysfunctional, especially as it is found in the context of the family. Dysfunctional means human relationships that do not work the way they are intended to work. Very simple definition. Human relationships that do not work the way they are intended to work. Dysfunctional families, I believe, is the number one problem in America today. It really is. We live in a nation of dysfunctional families and broken homes. But I have some news for you. Everybody's family is dysfunctional. There is no certain thing as a perfect family. There is no perfect family. Your family is not perfect. My family is not perfect. Your family is dysfunctional, and my family is dysfunctional. And it can be traced, that is, the cause for it, all the way back to the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve, when they disobeyed the Lord and took of that forbidden fruit and cause sin to enter into the world. And Paul tells us in the book of Romans that we will all die because we have all sinned. Through one man's disobedience, sin came into the world. And it has affected every individual ever born into this world or ever will be born into the world. There is no such thing as a perfect family. We are all, to some degree, dysfunctional. But what I want to do today is to take you through the family history of Joseph. One pastor referred to Joseph as living in the most dysfunctional family in all the scriptures. He lived at Dysfunctional Junction is where he lived. And so I want to go back and start with his great-grandparents and work you all the way through it and then come out and help you to realize that it is possible for you to break the cycle of a dysfunctional family. Because Joseph was able to do it. And you can too. So we go back to the 12th chapter of Genesis. And in the 12th chapter of Genesis, you have the account of Abraham being called by the Lord out of the land of Ur. Evidently, Abraham was at one time a pagan. We don't have a record of how God spoke to him and dealt with him other than that God called him out of the land of Ur. And he and his wife Sarah and Abraham's nephew Lot left Ur to go to where? Abraham did not know. God did not tell him. But as you open the 12th chapter of the book of Genesis, we are aware of the fact that he went down to Egypt. And when he got down to Egypt, he told a lie. First thing that we know about Abraham is that he was a liar. Because he got down to Egypt and he was afraid that because Sarah, his wife, was a very beautiful, a very attractive woman, that Pharaoh would take her away from him and kill him. And so rather than for that to happen, Abraham says to Abraham, "You tell Pharaoh that you're my sister." And so she did, and so Pharaoh took her into his harem. But then, of course, the Lord spoke to Pharaoh. He realized something was wrong. He confronted Abraham and said, "Why did you deceive me? Why did you lie to me? She is your wife, not your sister." And so he gave her back to Abraham. Then you have Lot. Lot is Abraham's nephew. Both Lot and Abraham prosper to the point that there's no longer room enough for both of them to reside together. And so Abraham graciously gives Lot the first choice. You look this way. If you go this way, I'll go the other way and so forth. And so Lot decided to cast his lot to Sodom and Gomorrah. Some of the two places with some of the most vile, wicked people that ever lived. Sodomites are those who are homosexuals and engage in homosexual activities, and that was the lifestyle of the majority of the people in the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so Lot cast his lot in that direction. The sin became so great that God decided he was going to have to destroy those two cities, and so he sent angels to the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and to the house of Lot to warn Lot to get out because God was going to send judgment in the form of firestones upon those people, and they needed to get out. Lot entertains the two angels. These angels are there. The men of the city think that they are men. They go knocking on Lot's door, demanding that Lot release them because they want to have a homosexual relationship with them. Lot comes out, and he says to them, "Don't do such a horrible thing. I have two daughters. Both of them are virgins. I will turn them over to you, and you can do with them whatever you please. Just do not harm these two men." The angels reached out and grabbed Lot by his collar and dragged him back in, caused the men to go blind so they couldn't find the house and the door to Lot's house. And so the angels say to Lot, "You go get your future son-in-laws and tell them get out of town because judgment is coming." Lot goes to his two future son-in-laws and to tell them this, but they mock him and laugh at him and think that he's joking and not taking them seriously. He goes back home. He gets his his two daughters and his wife, and the next morning the angel says, leave, judgment cannot come until you leave, and so he leaves. In the process of leaving, the firestones fall, the cities are destroyed, Lot's wife turns and looks back, turns into a pillar of salt. Then they go to a cave, Lot and his two daughters. His two daughters begin to talk between themselves and say, we have no men to be husbands. Let's get our father drunk. And let's have a sexual relationship with him, and so that we can conceive and have children. And so that's what they do. The youngest one has the first time, and she gets the father drunk, has a sexual relationship, becomes pregnant. The next night, the older one does the same. Incest has been committed. Then fast forward to the 20th chapter of the book of Genesis. This time, Abraham and Sarah go to the land of Gerar. There's King Amalek. And again, Abraham turns to his wife Sarah and says to her, let's tell him that you are my sister, lest again they take me and kill me and he has you. And so again, she becomes a member of the king's harem. And again, the Lord speaks to Abimelech and tells him that this is Abraham's wife and that he should not harm her. He confronts Abraham about it. Abraham said, well, again, I was afraid that if you knew that she was my wife, you would kill me and take her. But actually, she is my sister. She is my half-sister. Oh, this is a half a lie rather than a full lie. You know, half a lie is a lot better than a full lie. So really, she is my half-sister. It's just a partial lie that he's now telling her. But again, he turns Sarah back to Abraham, and they continue on their way. As you know, the Lord has promised Abraham and Sarah that they will have a son, and that it will be through this son that God will bless the world. They are getting on in age. Abraham and Sarah are. Sarah is getting past the point that she is able to conceive. And so they get impatient. And Sarah comes up with this idea. If you look at the 16th chapter of the book of Genesis, this is where we want to point out some things to you. In Genesis 16 in verse 1, now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. And so Sarah said to Abraham, the Lord has promised me a son, you a son, I can't have children, so let's try to have a child through my handmaid Hagar. And so at Sarah's idea, at her insistence, Abraham is not reluctant to have a sexual relationship with another woman. So we have a free marriage here, he agrees. And so it says in verse 4 of chapter 16, he went into Hagar. She conceived. When she saw that she had conceived, that is, when Sarah saw that Hagar had conceived, Sarah was despised her. So there is a despicable attitude in her heart toward Hagar. Verse 5, Sarah said to Abram, may the wrong done me be upon you. Now, isn't it like a woman that she would... suggest to her husband that he do something that is immoral, and then when he does it, she blames him. It was her idea, and yet she says, may the wrong done be upon you. I gave my maid unto your arms, but when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her sight. May the Lord judge between you and me. That is, may the Lord decide who's guilty, you or me. But verse 6, Abraham said to Sarah, behold, your maid is in your power. Do to her what is good in your sight. And so Sarah treated her harshly. So here you have an adulterous relationship, a shifting of blame, jealousy, despising one another, and then a ruptured relationship of treating her in a very harsh and cruel manner. Then you go on over into the book of Genesis, and this time look at chapter 21, where Isaac is born. In chapter 21, again, in her old age, God performs a miracle. Sarah is able to conceive. She gives birth to a son. They name him Isaac, which means laughter. But notice in Genesis chapter 21 and verse 9, now Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian whom she had borne to Abraham, mocking. So now Ishmael, which was the name that they had given to this son that was born to Hagar, Ishmael mocks Sarah, mocks Abraham, mocks the fact that they've had a child. It upsets Sarah to the point in verse 10, it says, "Therefore she said to Abraham, drive out this maid and her son, for the son of this maid shall not be an heir with my son Isaac. And the matter distressed Abraham greatly because of his son." And so now Abraham is distressed again because things are not working out the way that he had hoped that they would work out. Then we'll fast forward again, this time to chapter 24, where Isaac is old enough to be married. He does not have a fiance, so Abraham sends his servant out to find one for him. And lo and behold, he finds Rebekah in chapter 24 and verse 15. Before he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with her jar on her shoulder, and it is love at first sight. If you look at chapter 24 and verse 29, it says, "Now Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban." Laban. We'll come back to that in a moment. Fast forward again to chapter 25. And Rebekah conceives. She has twins. In chapter 25 and verse 22, it says that the twins struggled together within her while they were still in her womb. They were struggling. This, of course, I think is symbolic of what's going to happen after the two are born. But then skip down to chapter 25 and verse 28. Now, Isaac loved Esau because they named the two boys, Esau and Jacob. Now, Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. So now you have favoritism. The mother loves one, the father loves the other, and evidently as the boys grow up, there is no doubt about the favoritism that exists among the family members, that the mother loves Jacob, the father loves Esau. And in verse 34 of chapter 25, it says, "Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way, and thus Esau despised his birthright." And the reason why he despised his birthright is because Jacob cheated him out of it. They came in, Esau did one day from hunting out in the field. He was hungry. Jacob was a mama's boy. He was the first chef. He gave Emeril a run for his money. He came in, he was making a stew. He put in the potatoes, the tomatoes, the celery, the carrots, and bam, it was a stew. And the aroma filled the house, and Esau was hungry, and he said, "Well, if you want some of my stew, you're going to have to sell me your birthright." And Esau said, "Well, what will my birthright, what good will it do me if I die of starvation?" And so he signed over his birthright to Jacob, and therefore he despised his birthright. Then if you'll come over to chapter 27, time has passed. Isaac is old. His eyesight is bad. He can't see very well, but he knows he's dying. And before he dies, he wants to give his blessing to Esau because he favors Esau. And so tells Esau, calls him in, and he says, "I want you to go out and hunt for me and bring the game and prepare it the best way I enjoy it and serve it, and then I will bless you." Well, notice in chapter 27 at verse 5 that Rebekah was eavesdropping. Rebekah was listening while Isaac spoke to his son. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "Behold, I heard your father speak." And here, and she begins to give him instructions. She says, "You go and get a couple of goats. Bring them to me, and I will prepare them for your father so that he'll bless you rather than to bless Esau." And so he does this, but he says, well, what will happen if I'm discovered? And dad knows that it's not Esau. And she said, "Don't you worry about that. I'll take the blame for it." And so he goes out and he does this. But notice in chapter 27 and verse 19, Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I've done as you've told me. Get up, please sit and eat my game, that you may bless me." And Isaac said to his son, "How is it that it's so quickly? You've done this so soon?" And And Jacob lies. He says, because the Lord your God caused it to happen to me. Well, God had nothing to do with this. So he's lying to his father. Verse 21, Isaac said to Jacob, please come close that I may feel you. In verse 22, Jacob came close. His father felt him. He said, well, the voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are Esau's. Skip down to verse 27. Again, he tells him to come close that he can kiss him. And so in verse 27, he came close and kissed him. And when he smelled the smell of his garments, he blessed him. Notice in verse 21, there's the feel, the touch. Verse 22, the voice, the ear. Verse 27, the smell, the odor. So he's got the touch, the voice, the ability to smell. He's tricked. He's deceived. He's been lied to. And now he gives the blessing to Jacob rather than to Esau. Esau comes in and unfortunately discovers what has happened. So if you look at verse 34, when Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry. And he said to his father, bless me, even me also, O my father. And he said, your brother came deceitfully and has taken away your blessing. And so Esau said to him, is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and now he's taken away my blessing. Oh, the animosity and hatred is increasing here. You skip down to verse 41 of chapter 27. So Esau bore a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are near, and then I will kill my brother Jacob. Verse 42, Rebekah gets a hold of Jacob and tells him to go get away because his brother is planning to kill him. So now you've got murder on your hands and on your mind. Go to chapter 27 and verse 46. Verse 46, Rebekah said to Isaac, I am tired of living because of the daughters of Heth. Now she's tired of living. Sometimes all of us get to that point at some time or another in our lives when we are tired of living, but she says the reason for it is because of the daughters of Heth. Now, who in the world are the daughters of Heth? If you go back to chapter 26 and look at verse 34, chapter 26 and verse 34 says, when Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, the daughter of Beor, the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite. So he married the daughters of Heth. The Heth and the Hittites were pagan people. And so Esau married outside of the family in opposition to the way his father wanted him to. And if you look down at chapter 28, verses 8 and 9, Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan displeased his father. That is, he knew that Esau, that he knew that Jacob and Rebekah were not happy that he had married women that they didn't want him to marry. And so what does he do? In verse 9, Esau went to Ishmael and married one of his daughters in an attempt to make up with his father in the hopes that his father would change his mind and change the will back to the way it was supposed to have been. But it was to no avail. Once Isaac blessed Esau, it could not be taken back. So now you've got an attempt to appease a father, and it's just not working. It's just not working. Fast forward again to chapter 29. Jacob meets Rachel, and you'll notice in chapter 29, verse 11, then Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. That's not the first, it's the first time, I guess, but maybe not the last one, that a man kissed his future wife and cried about it, I guess. Okay, a minute. All right. Look at verse 17, chapter 29. Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful of form and face. She was a good-looking woman. Verse 18, now Jacob loved Rachel. Then, of course, they get married. That is, he goes to Laban and he says, I love your daughter Rachel. I'm willing to do whatever I can to marry her. What do you say? He said, you got to work for her for 7 years. No problem. He works 7 years for Rachel. They get married. On the wedding night, they consummate their relationship. The next morning, they wake up, he lifts up the veil, and lo and behold, the cheater has been cheated. It's not Rachel, it's Leah, the girl with the weak eyes. And he goes to Laban and he complains, "You were supposed to give me Rachel." He said, "Oh, but in our custom and practice, the oldest daughter has to marry first. So you had to marry Leah before I can give you Rachel." So he worked 7 more years for her. But notice something in chapter 29. Look at verse 31. "Now the Lord saw that Leah was unloved." Verse 32. "Leah conceived and bore a son, named him Reuben, for she said, 'Because the Lord has seen my affliction, surely now my husband will love me.'" Verse 33, "Because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, she has another child and another child." And in verse 34, "This time my husband will become attached to me." But look at chapter 30, verse 1. "Now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she became jealous of her sister, and she said to Jacob, 'Give me children or else I die.' And Jacob's anger burned against" who? Rachel, his first love, his only love. He gets mad at Rachel because of her attitude. And so it goes on and on and on. In chapter 31, he doesn't get along with his father-in-law. His father-in-law cheats him. And so now he's decided he's had enough of it. He's going to go back home. So in chapter 31, in verse 2, he gets his two wives together, Leah and Rachel. He says in chapter 31, verse 2, "Jacob saw the attitude of Laban, and behold, it was not friendly toward him as it had been." So now his father-in-law and he doesn't get along. And he decides, "I'm going to leave this place." And so he starts to leave. And Rachel... I'm going to summarize it quickly now because we've got some application here right quick that I need to share with you. Rachel steals from her father. She steals idols because Laban and Rachel are idolaters. And so she steals these from them. Laban finds it out. He goes in pursuit of them. He catches up with them. Jacob denies knowing anything at all about it. And he didn't because Rachel had done this behind his back. So Laban demands that he be allowed to search the tent. He doesn't trust them. So he searches the tent, can't find them. So he says, "Let's come up with a covenant." So in chapter 31, they come up with a covenant called the Covenant of Mizpah. But boy, it's an unusual covenant because in verse 49 of chapter 31, he says, "May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. If you mistreat my daughters or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us to see it, God is witness between you and me." In other words, he says, "I don't trust you. You don't trust me. When we are apart, God watches over you. God will watch over me. And if you mistreat my daughters, may God judge you for that." So it's a dysfunctional family here. Go on now, and we must hurry because of the time. But Joseph is born. As you know, he and his brothers do not get along. Joseph gives a bad report about his brothers. This is in chapter 37. Joseph gives a bad report about his brothers. He has dreams. He shares his dreams with his brothers. They become jealous of him. They hate him because of this. He's lord. He's the youngest. He's the baby of the family, and yet he's lording this over them. And so they hate him for it. The father has made a coat of many colors for him. He walks around in that. It's a royalty. That's the way they dress. The brothers don't have that. Evidently, there's favoritism here. And the boys know it. The brothers know it. They hate Joseph. They're jealous of Joseph. They decide to kill him. Reuben steps in and says, "No, let's don't kill him. Let's sell him as a slave." So this caravan comes along. They sell Joseph. He becomes a slave. He ends up down in Egypt. He is a slave to Potiphar, who is the captain of the army. Potiphar's wife tries to seduce him. "Come lie with me, commit adultery with me." Thankfully, he refuses to do so. He jumps out the window. She grabs his coat. When Potiphar gets home, she shares the coat with him, says, "He tried to rape me." And Potiphar throws him in jail. And he's there for a long time. And, of course, ultimately, you know the story, how eventually Joseph is promoted. He gets out of prison. He's promoted second only in authority and power to Pharaoh himself. A famine takes place. Isaac sends his sons to Egypt to get food, and that's where they meet Joseph, and this is where we come in, where we read a moment ago that Joseph's with his brothers. He's introduced himself to them, revealed himself to them. Their father dies. He's promised to take his father's body back home to bury. And now they're back. And now the boys are concerned. Revenge time has come. But the cycle of dysfunction in this family is broken. And a cycle of dysfunction can be broken in your home as well, should you exist and live in that kind of situation or have in the past. And I want to quickly suggest to you seven things that if you will do these seven things, it will help you to break the cycle of a dysfunctional family. And the first thing that you need to do is to trust the Lord. Put your trust in the Lord. This is what Joseph does. And let me go back, and I wanted to share this with you quickly. I went back and summarized words and attitudes that you see in this dysfunctional family, from Abraham to Joseph. Listen to these words: lying, treachery, homosexual lifestyle, deception, hatred, adultery, jealousy, anger, incest, distress, favoritism, scheming, frustration, desperation, killing, unhappiness, distrust, suspicion, idolatry, fear, depression, slavery, betrayal, seduction, injustice, and selfishness. You talk about a reality show. Man, here are all the ingredients of a reality show of a dysfunctional family. And this is the background out of which Joseph has come. And I believe that one of the reasons why he was able to break the cycle was because of his trust in the Lord. He had put his trust and his faith in the Lord. If you will look on your outline at chapter 45 and verses 5 through 9. Chapter 45, verses 5 through 9. Notice what Joseph says to his brothers when he reveals to him who he is. In verse 5 of chapter 45, it says, "Now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. God sent me here. God sent me before you to preserve me." Look at verse 7. "God sent me." Verse 8. "God sent me." Verse 9. "God has made me." So you see, he's giving God the credit. He's giving God the credit. Look back at chapter 50 and verses 19 and 20. "But Joseph said to them, 'Do not be afraid, for I am in God's place. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good.'" So through all of this now, Joseph testifies that he's put his faith in the Lord and that he's turned his life and his situation over the Lord. And he says, "You didn't send me here, God did. God sent me here. God sent me here. I'm where God wants me to be." You see, the Old Testament character of Joseph is an Old Testament example of Romans 8:28. "For we know that all things work together for good to them that love God and that are called according to his purpose." So if you want to break the cycle of dysfunction, then you trust the Lord that he is the God of circumstances. And that all you have to do is to put your faith in the Lord. There's a magazine that we provide here in our church for men called Stand Firm. And last Friday's devotional had this comment. Of all things, it says that your faith is the victory. Notice what the devotional says. "Regardless of the outcome of your circumstances, keep faith in God. In the spiritual realm, faith is the victory. Even if the illness returns, the job evaporates, or the child goes astray, it is your determined faith in the darkest hour that amazes angels and wins the applause of heaven. Your faith will be tested again and again. Expect it. Keep trusting and following God when the trials come. Remember, outcomes are secondary, but faith is primary. Keep the faith and let God take care of the rest." So no matter what your circumstance may be, no matter what difficulty, no matter what dysfunctional thing is going on in your life or has gone on in your life, trust God to work it out for you. Number two, forgive. Forgive. This is in chapter 45 again, this time in verse 15. In chapter 45 and verse 15, it says that when he revealed himself to his brothers and told them that God had worked it out, in verse 15 says, he kissed all of his brothers and wept on them, and afterwards his brothers talked with him. Now, the word forgiveness is not found there, but the attitude is. He didn't curse his brothers. He didn't sentence them. He said, "Well, I spent some time in prison. You're going to spend time in prison. I had to suffer. You're going to have to." None of that. He weeps. He cries. He expresses forgiveness. He hugs them. He sits down and talks with them. There's forgiveness here. Go back to chapter 50 and verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph bears a grudge against us?" So they sent a message to Joseph. "Your father charged before he died." And they quote their father. This is what the father said. "Please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did wrong." That they're quoting their father here. Now they say themselves, "Please forgive the transgression of your servants." They ask for forgiveness. And so Joseph gives it to them. Number three, be humble. Be humble. Look at chapter 50, verse 17. "Please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers. Now please forgive the transgression of the servants of God, your father." And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. And then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we're your servants." So they humble themselves before Joseph. They ask for forgiveness. And if you can do the same, then you can break that cycle as well. Number four, be kind. Be kind to those who have harmed you. Look at chapter 45, verse 10. Notice what Joseph says to his brothers. "You shall live. You shall be near me." Verse 11, "I will provide for you." So Joseph doesn't, again, he doesn't curse them. He doesn't punish them in any way. He says, "You're going to live. Not only are you going to live, you're going to live close to me. And I am going to provide for you." And then in verse 50, chapter 50 and verse 21. "So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." And so he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So you speak kindly to them. You can accomplish a whole lot more without turning over the beehive. You can get a lot of honey if you don't do that. And so he's forgiving. They humble themselves. He doesn't curse them. He's kind to them. You remember what Jesus said? Be kind to those that despitefully love them. Love your enemies. Do good to them. Be kind to them. And so next, express your grief. We don't have the time to look at all of the verses, but look at chapter 45. In chapter 45 and the first three verses, Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried, "Have everyone go out from me." And so there was no man with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard of it. He wept. And this is not the only occasion. There are other. That's why I've written the verses down for you. You look them up. He wept, he wept, he wept, he wept. And at this point, he's weeping and he's crying out so loud, all the servants in his house hears him. And you know, if you're suffering, if you've been abused, if you've been cursed, if you have a father or mother who is an alcoholic, if your spouse or your wife is an alcoholic, if there's incest, if there's adultery, an adulterous affair, if there's hatred, bitterness, whatever there is in your family, weep over it. Weep and cry out to God. And ask for forgiveness and be kind one to another and humble yourself before God. And let your grief be expressed to him, to God. And then furthermore, confess. Confess your sin. Go back to chapter 42 and listen to these brothers. Listen to them. Man, they are convicted. Look at chapter 42 and verse 21. Then they said to one another, these are the brothers talking to each other. They said to one another, "Truly we are guilty concerning our brother because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us. Yet we would not listen. Therefore, this distress has come upon us." Reuben answered them, saying, "Did I not tell you, do not sin against this boy, and you would not listen? Now comes the reckoning for his blood." Notice verse 23. They did not know, however, that Joseph understood, for there was an interpreter between them. They didn't know who Joseph was at this point. They didn't know that Joseph could understand Hebrew. And so Joseph hears them talking between them and among themselves, said, "We're guilty." Reuben said, "Didn't I tell you we shouldn't do this? Now we're suffering for it." And so they confess, they admit, "We were wrong." And then you go back to chapter 50, and this word that they're sharing, "The Father told us to come to you and ask for forgiveness because we did you wrong." And Joseph says, "Yes, you did. What you did to me, you intended evil to happen to me, but God took it and turned it out for my good. Praise be to God." And so there's confession here. Then there's a change. Change in the attitude. And we don't have the time to look at the verses, but there is one that I want to point out to you, and that's in chapter 45. Joseph has revealed himself to them. He says, your father's still alive. Benjamin is alive. Go get your dad and your brothers, and let's all bring them all back here. But notice what he says to them in chapter 45, and look at verse 24. He sends them on the way, and so he sent his brothers away, and as they parted, he said to them, do not quarrel on the journey. Don't quarrel. I wonder why he said that. Because they fussed and fought among themselves all of those years. He remembers how they did. Now change your attitude. Change your behavior. And then one final thing that's not on there, and I'm through. All of this can happen. You can break the cycle of dysfunction in your family if you want it broken. If you want it. If you don't want it, you can forget it. It's going to stay there. But if you want it, then you've got to put your trust in the Lord. You've got to have a forgiving spirit. You need to humble yourself before one another and before God. Be kind and grieve over it and confess and change your attitude and change your behavior. You say, I can't do that. No, you can't. But you remember what Paul says. I can do all things through him that strengtheneth me. No, you can't do it on your own. The Christian life is not difficult. It is impossible apart from the indwelling power and presence and strength of Almighty God. And if you want it, it's theirs. It's there for you. It's for the taking. If you want it bad enough, trust God enough, the cycle can be broken. Let's bow together. Father God, thank you for telling us the truth. And when we read the Bible and we read about people, you haven't covered up their sins. And you don't cover up ours. But what you did for Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and yes, for Joseph, and how you used all of those circumstances to break that cycle, it can happen for us today too. And so I pray for those of us who are here today who've had those kinds of experiences that has caused us hurt and harm, and we have been the victim of so many things, to learn to forgive, to be kind one to another, even as you, for Christ's sake, were kind and forgiving of us. In Jesus' name. Amen. Would you stand with me, please? And if God is leading you to make a decision today, I'll be here at the front to receive you.